Hello! Welcome to the Mind Buffs Podcast. I am your host, Matt Demwasak, and we're here back again with Linz.
Hello!
Our first several episodes were looking specifically at like coach-athlete relationships, looking at healthy examples, unhealthy examples, and we're going to continue on that trend of kind of looking at like power differentials within sport, broadly bringing those conversations and those examples to as many different industries as we can as well. Today, we're really excited that we're going to be jumping into kind of the unspoken rules of sport, the unspoken rules of coach-athlete relationship, because we're setting the stage for a theory that we're going to be breaking down over several episodes that was created by Celia Breckenridge and Carrie Fasting, just looking at power and control, like narratives within sport. There are several different aspects to this theory that are, it's important that we spend ample time looking at each one like at a deeper level. But before that, like today is going to be kind of context to the fact that even like us as sports psychologists, like we're part of that culture. We're embedded in those same rules and biases and norms. And I think when we pull each one of these situations out of context, you'll probably have these feelings of like, oh, that's kind of messed up, or like, oh yeah, that is what it was like. That's not okay. So we're going to be looking closely at what some of these things are that, especially for anyone that was in sport growing up, we all did this. We all just adapted and normalized to these things. And the first one that we're going to be talking about is some research that Linz had found that kind of pertains specifically to the rules around emotions. And I'm super excited about diving into this one.
Yeah, this is an interesting topic when we were talking about, yeah, all those things that have been normalized in sport. And then even figuring out what to talk about today, you're like, oh, that's not that weird. But if you, yeah, pull it out of context, you're like, that is weird. I am just part of it, like Matt, you said. Mm-hmm. So this study it's called the Normalization of Emotion and the Disregard of Health Problems in Elite Amateur Sport. It's by Jane Lee Sinden. It was super interesting just the way that it breaks down all the different things that have been normalized in sport. And like Matt said, there's these beliefs about emotion. So we'll go into each one, but just a quick overview. There's five beliefs about emotion. Sorry, I should say five misinterpretations about emotions. The first one's emotion as private, emotion as negative, emotion as feminine, emotion as irrational, and emotion as a sign of mental weakness. So we'll go in and kind of talk about each one of those that's explained throughout this study.
And like, I don't know about you, but even just hearing her mention those five, like I already feel like this weird twinge of like stress in my chest, whether it's because like, oh yeah, I did that thing, or like, oh yeah, I see that all the time. But it was just gross hearing like how that's articulated, but at the same time being like, oh shit, yeah, no, that's just exactly what happens though.
Yeah. Definitely. And I was just listening to a different podcast and Simone Biles was on it. So it's just interesting timing. And it was really cool hearing like her experience. We all know kind of what she went through. So it was interesting hearing this from her as well. So let's get into those misinterpretations a little bit. So emotion is private. It's kind of self-explanatory there. Just keep it to yourself. If I don't share the emotion, nobody's going to think that I'm weak, et cetera, et cetera. And this has just kind of been going on for forever. This story talks about like all these different theories throughout the 80s even, where emotions were just simply not a thing to be expressed or experienced publicly.
And just entire cultures of people like have always believed that as well, that emotions are private and must not be shared. We actually had a really interesting conversation a few months ago at the office, kind of looking at what the similarities or the differences were between like privacy and vulnerability, and also kind of bringing in like personality, like tendencies, like how much is our preference for privacy based on our personality versus a fear of being vulnerable. And like, this isn't like a black and white conversation. There's no right or wrong answer, but just adding language to that conversation, especially if you're kind of that person that's like, I'm a very private person, you might be 100% correct. But are you talking about privacy, or are you talking about because of your upbringing, whether through sport or in home, that like when you share emotion, bad juju happens afterwards? So yeah, that's the first thing that I thought of when I heard like you have to keep your emotions private.
Mm-hmm. And I like that you said that it's not black and white. It is very gray, because yeah, your upbringing, your culture also is a huge one too. Some cultures just have that view or mindset of keeping your emotions private, which yeah, just adds enough extra layer. So as we talk about this,
yeah,
it's hard. We know it's hard.
Like, did you ever talk to a coach about how your feelings were?
I don't think so. Which is interesting. This is what this study talks about, which we'll get into a little bit more deeply too, of if you are like, well, I don't talk to my coaches about my emotions, you're not a black sheep. Mm-hmm. That is a very common thing. But should it be common is what we're trying to get at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's especially even more so like as a guy in men's sport, like emotion, are you kidding me? Emotion is like you slamming your stick on the boards or like punching someone in the face. And those are more like, those are normalized expressions of emotion. But yeah, no, bros in the locker room ain't talking about like how that game made them feel afterwards.
Yeah, which leads into another one of emotion as feminine.
Mm.
And again, self-explanatory a bit, but the good old saying of girls are too emotional, women are too emotional, boys don't cry, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much what this view is kind of trying to explain, or this misinterpretation, or like girls don't get angry, that type of thing, and having to stay poised, right? Just a bunch of nonsense.
Like scientifically untrue.
Mm-hmm.
Like a person's relationships to their own feelings, again, is just another conversation around like what their personality is. It's not male or female. It's not masculine, feminine. It's just, where am I on that spectrum between like interacting with people in the world more logically as opposed to emotionally? Like I see just as many men who struggle like in their personal relationships because their partner isn't emotionally available for them, but because of the stigma around, you know, men aren't supposed to have feelings, or that's a girly thing to have. It has literally nothing to do with whether or not you are a guy or a girl. It is just a genetic predisposition towards expressing emotion.
Mm-hmm. And that is like, all of this is so contradicting too, because you're saying, okay, emotion is feminine. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if I identify as a male, I can't express emotion because that's going to make me look weak like a girl. But also, if you identify as a girl and you express emotion, you can't do it with any anger or anything like that because it's too masculine. So imagine telling like a kid about these
rules.
Rules, and they're like, can I feel emotion or not? Or if I have to feel emotion, it can't be angry, or it can only be dramatic. You know, it's just very confusing.
Oh, it's so confusing.
Yeah. Next one is emotion as negative. So that's just like seeing that if you express emotions, it's a bad thing. That's the basic idea of that one. So in sport, if you can't keep your emotions in check, then there's something wrong with you. And your performance is not going to be good because you're showing your emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't know this is where I was going to be going in my side quest comments to like what you're talking about. But again, like flow state, for example, being in the zone is not I've said this before, it's not a state you think yourself into. It's a feeling state. So if naturally you are more of an emotional human being, you are only going to be able to be in flow state if you're allowed and feel safe and comfortable to be your emotionally expressive self, even during performance. But if your sport has ingrained in you that like showing emotion is weak, that means that you stand such a small chance of actually experiencing flow state, because you're denying yourself the right emotional state to even get that good stuff. Mm-hmm. Like,
I'm so glad you said that. That's making so many ideas come up. The flow state stuff. Okay, let's talk about me, for example,
okay,
to paint a picture. if you've done our zone performance presentation, whether you are a client or you've come to a team session, you would know if you've done it with me that I'm an 8, which means that I need a lot of emotional stimulus to get into the zone because I'm extroverted and I like a lot of loud music and I like to joke around with teammates and stuff. That also makes me think of something that's been normalized in the sport world. If you're having fun and goofing around, you're not dialed in and you're not focused.
Oh, so it's so good. Yeah.
So that's what's coming up for me right now. And yeah, as these emotions are bad. So if you picture me, somebody who needs to be hyped up, quote unquote, to be able to be in my zone and to play my best. And then at the same time, I'm being told you need to settle down, like you're being too emotional. Could you hear the eye roll in that? Like that would pull me out of my zone because I'm like, oh, okay, I can't be that hyped up. But then I'm going to be below my zone and I'm not going to play as well as I should.
Yeah. Emotions are only negative if like you're the kind of person that needs to remain like more cerebral, like more strategic, more logical, analytical, and emotions can get in the way of you accessing your best strengths when it comes to performance. But inherently, there's no such thing as like negative emotion. It's just simply neutral information. It's neutral data that we as a culture, as a species, have just been given very little opportunity to learn what that language is and what we can do for it. But within sport, we know it is just not allowed.
And another really interesting part of this emotion is negative thing, and more related to that actual work that we do with clients. There's this technique called thought stoppage, where you pretty much just tell yourself to stop thinking that thought in the moment. But I think that sometimes this gets taken to too far of an extent, and people take it as I can never think that thought or I can never feel that feeling. And this study talks about like, rather than doing that, getting to this place where you learn to feel your emotions and learn to manage them as you are performing so that you don't get to this point of just pushing it away time and time again and never allowing yourself to experience that emotion. Because then when athletes or whoever does have to experience an emotion, they've never allowed themselves to go through the whole process. So it's uncomfortable when you don't know what's going on. So that gets super confusing too. All right. Emotion as irrational.
You're seeing a trend here?
Yeah. Like we said, when you pull it out of context, it just sounds so silly, ridiculous. So the study just talks about how emotions have stereotypically been portrayed as irrational and they should not be shown publicly, right? If you want people to think that you are quote unquote normal, don't show big emotions because then people aren't going to stare at you and judge you and all of that. So again, think of an athlete I'm sure everybody can think of an athlete who does show their emotions, but everybody knows who that athlete is because they show their emotions. That makes me think of another example of a client just told me that, well, this athlete that I know is like a robot and they don't show any emotion when they're playing. And I was like, that sounds kind of boring. Right? So maybe this person, like we said previously, had gotten really good at that thought stoppage, mm-hmm. but to the point where they don't experience anything, no highs, no lows.
Yeah.
Don't you want to experience highs and like have fun? And if you do experience lows, take cues from it. Do I need to change something? How do I work through it? And so on.
I think, again, like a misconception is that logic and emotion are mutually exclusive. You can't have one with the other. If you are emotional, you can't be logical. If you're logical, there's no room for emotion. That's not true. They're different parts of self that do not operate on completely different like systems. You can have both a logical understanding of the task that is required and an emotional investment, commitment, excitement to pursuing that logical outcome. Like both can work seamlessly together. And the problem is by approaching, the concept of logic and emotion as them being mutually exclusive, we unintentionally create disconnection of self. And disconnection of self is on the opposite end of the spectrum as flow state, right? Flow state is a full unity, full harmony of self committed to whatever that most important thing is in the moment. And if we are trying to remove a part of our experience from the performance, we are denied entry into flow state. So we have to learn how to bring harmony to both emotion and logic. And that's going to be different from person to person.
Mm-hmm. And another point too about the emotion as irrational. If you are teaching somebody that their emotional reaction to something that, let's say, is like unfair or unjust, and you are teaching them to not have an emotional reaction, again, the confusion of that, of isn't it rational to have an emotional response when something has been completely unfair or whatever happens? So that becomes this beast to try to figure out as an athlete of, well, this injustice is happening to me, and I know that I should have an emotional response to it, but I've been told that that's not normal. And again, it forces people to repress their emotions and not allow themselves to, access that part of themselves, like you said.
Yeah. In a few weeks, there's going to be an episode where Kayla and I talk about the very misunderstood and misused term of mentally tough. And essentially, that has been a sport trope that's been used to squash any attempt at having, feeling, or expressing emotion, that you just need to be mentally tough. You can't be bothered by your feelings. And we're going to strip that down into nuts and bolts in a couple of weeks. But yeah, even that term itself it's kind of been bastardized. There's nothing wrong with it, like when you look at it like objectively, but how it's been used in sport after decades, it's got to go.
Sure does. Okay, the fifth one is that emotion as a sign of mental weakness. So this one was interesting. There was this mental hygiene movement in the 30s. Have you heard of this before?
I have no idea where we're going.
Right? So it framed emotions as symptoms of mental illness.
What?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Me neither. That's why this has been very interesting. So yeah, this mental hygiene movement basically just thought any emotion was a sign of a mental illness rather than, the criteria that you'd see in the DSM today.
What's interesting is that actually the timing of that theory has just kind of reminded me of like the dirty 30s, the Great Depression. Like, I think it was like basically the entire 30s are like 1929 to 39, just at a time that was incredibly bleak and hard. There was suffering happening like on a global scale everywhere. I just think it's interesting that there would be like a theory pertaining to emotion as like a mental health issue at a time that probably required obscene amounts of like hardiness and grit to be able to get through those years. But I have nothing but just a curious correlation that I'm sharing there. But that's really cool. I had no idea that mental hygiene.
Yeah, that's not what like first came to my mind when I thought mental hygiene. I was like to me, I'm like, oh, we're taking care of our mental health. That's what I first. So then when I read,
we're plucking.
Yes. Which then it talks about how emotional children were then slated to join the ranks of the mentally ill or the social misfits if they didn't catch them early enough.
Whoa.
Yeah. Which then is now translated into high performance sport.
Yeah.
Where same thing. You don't show emotions and you show that you're mentally tough.
Wow.
Yeah.
My mind is blown. I just want to do a whole bunch of more reading on this. That's so interesting.
Yeah. That one was crazy. But yeah, so those are the five misinterpretations of emotions. As you can probably see, they are totally irrational.
Yeah.
Yes.
Super unhealthy.
Yeah.
Yet like no one challenged them, at least in my generation. Growing up in sport, that was just what it was. Suck it up, princess.
Yeah. Maybe it'd be fun before we go into like the results of the study to talk about some like things that have been normalized in sport that we even think are still normal.
Yeah.
As athletes, not as sport psychs. That'd be kind of funny to pull apart.
Yeah.
Running for punishment.
Oh.
What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think I can use the word triggered. I immediately just started feeling stressed in my chest when you said that because, I mean, in hockey, it's known as the bag skate. Like in basketball, what is it called? In like the suicides?
Suicides or sidelines? 7-11, 17, 11-7. It's like the ladder. Yeah. If you know, you know.
And it was never a joyous occasion. It was never a challenge. There was no games involved when it came to trying to improve cardio. We only ever worked on cardio as a consequence. So even to this day, like I have a really negative association to cardio. Like the pain of like the discomfort feels like pain really soon because it just reminds me of coaches yelling at us and like sticks banging on the ice and like whacking us on the ass to like get us going. And I mean, that was a part of hockey from as young as like 11 years old, you know, and it was a threat. Right. If you don't pull your heads out of your asses and like, you know, play a hard third period, we're going to bag skate you like tomorrow. Like it was never. So, yeah, I vote no. I don't like it.
I have a mixed view of it. I, yes, have. I've ran many a sidelines in my life. My mixed feelings of it is that depending on your sport, like, you have to be in good shape. I've told you, like, we ran a lot, but we would win games because we were in such good shape.
Yeah.
That is the side of it that I agree with. But I guess that's not really a punishment.
No.
But when it's framed as a punishment, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Right? So I think if you're like a coach listening, the way that you can look at it is, how can I frame this conditioning as a positive of as this is just going to make you a stronger player rather than, oh, you didn't, I don't know, hit as many shots as you were supposed to in the time. So you're running rather than looking at it that way, because then it creates like a negativity around the sidelines.
100%. Don't turn something that you want your athletes to be good at into a massive negative experience. If you want to be a team that can play hard until the final buzzer, don't turn the skill required to be able to do that into something that everyone loathes and feels ashamed for having to do. Like, talk about irrational. It doesn't make sense to use cardio as a weapon because your team will be able to have a long run through playoffs if you're a well-conditioned team. So yeah, there's no logical reasoning behind using cardio as punishment.
No, but that ties into another thing that's been normalized that if you pick apart, it is not or should not be, is with the conditioning, isolating certain players because everybody has to finish the sidelines by the 30-second mark. If you don't, you run again. Let's be honest. You know that there's going to be one or two people on your team that aren't going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's humiliating.
Mm-hmm.
We ran, I swear to God, like 130 sidelines one practice because one player just couldn't finish it. But then you run them over and over and over again and you think, and then now several people aren't making it because we're begged, right? But then what happens, that this is another thing that becomes normalized in sport, is you start to get mad at that player because you're like, just make the sideline, just make the time, I'm exhausted, right? Mm-hmm. So it creates this like competitive, angry feeling towards a teammate. And that I really disagree with. You should not be creating that type of atmosphere.
It's like a manipulative tactic that coaches use where they like scapegoat a player on the team, kind of like absolving them of having like created a shitty situation for the team. And now the whole team is against that player rather than like blaming the coach for why they're still running sidelines.
Yeah.
And you pretty much have lost the trust of that player for the rest of the season. Just takes one of those moments.
Yeah.
You've lost them. You cannot possibly expect that they will be able to perform at their best when you have made an example out of them. Shit just doesn't work.
No. And that one like really makes, like leads into this other one I want to bring up is like, I just said it, the competitive at teammates and other players. We'll describe competitive at versus competitive with first. Competitive at is you're competing with somebody who's on a different team, ideally, right? Competitive with is you are competing with a teammate with the goal of like making each other better.
Whereas like at is like, I hope that they fail.
Yeah.
I hope that they make a mistake. I hope they suck. Yeah.
And I've been on a team where that was the like atmosphere, the situation that the coach wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not like another girl because we were the same position. So if one of us played over the other, we were like literally mad at each other outside of basketball. But like now saying it out loud, it's like, I actually love that person and I want to be friends with them. But I was like forced into this like super weird, I have to not like them and I have to be aggressive with them in order to beat them.
I want to play devil's advocate for a second. Mm-hmm. Not that I disagree with you. Mm. From a performance standpoint, right? As a strategy from a coach, knowing that you were pitted against that one mm-hmm. teammate, did it improve your performance? Did it make you play harder, work harder? Like
this specific person, it got to the point where we were like literally like pushing each other though. So mm-hmm. I think it got too far where mm-hmm. yes, I think it's a fine line. I know what you're saying. And yes, competing, I don't think that they're necessarily always separate, like this competitive at and competitive with, because like what you're getting at of it's good because you're pushing each other, you're getting better. Mm-hmm. And then it gets to that point where, okay, now I'm like two hand pushing each other and like somebody's going to get injured. That's kind of what it would get to.
Yeah. Because I know there'll be people like listening to this conversation being like, oh, but it gets the results. Like the team mm-hmm. benefits mm-hmm. by pitting certain teammates against each other to like fight for those like positions. And I don't think that the intent is incorrect. Mm-hmm. But I believe that the impact of having created unhealthy comparison and competition becomes this kind of poison that you start dropping into the well. Mm-hmm. And then by the time playoffs roll around, you have a team divided.
Yes.
Rather than unified. Even if in the short term, you might see a couple games where like that one player you pit against the other had the game of their life and you're thinking, it worked. Mm-hmm. My strategy worked. Mm-hmm.
No, I think you're exactly right. It's how you frame it. I think that's the thing here, that impact versus intent that we talked about last time. Mm-hmm. It can be a very good strategic plan to improve performance. But yeah, like you said, creating that divide on the team. You want to be happy for your teammates, right? And you all want to be getting better. So yeah. Again, just another topic that we cover that is not just black and white and it's not simple. But okay, do you want one more?
Oh yeah, hit me.
Oh my gosh, I've got a lot.
Okay, well, let's just get them.
Okay. The other one's commenting on bodies or the amount of food eating not eaten.
Never mind. This is going to take an hour.
We'll do a whole other episode on body image. Don't worry. that one I think also goes with the conditioning, the training that you do.
Yeah. I'm actually really curious because like there definitely are memories that come to my mind like as a guy. When it comes to like body image and eating, that we're actually super normalized. Like I'm a skinnier guy. It doesn't matter what the hell I do. Like this is the body that I've been given, and I played a physical sport in hockey. So I was made fun of like all the time by my teammates because of like how skinny I was. And especially like come junior, like coaches would just look at me and be like, man, you're way too scrawny. Like you can't do it. Even though if we went to the gym, right? And we all did, let's do chest press, let's do leg press. Like I'm lifting the exact same weights as these 200 pound guys, but like I have a very compact frame. But all of the comments that were made to me was that like, you're weak, you're small. Clearly you're not going to be like strong enough. So I was always made fun of my body type in a sport that kind of culturally demanded more size, especially like 20 years ago when I was playing, where that big, rough and tough hockey player was, that power forward was still something that was highly coveted. Whereas like now, like someone of my build is just a common thing to see at the NHL level. But like that was kind of my experience with just kind of abusing relationship with body.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yuck.
I'm a skinny white ginger. I didn't stand a chance, Linz.
Where's your soul?
Somewhere. Still looking for it.
But yeah, we're going to do an entire episode on body food comments with coaches and teammates. Another one is the weigh-ins though, that came up in the study that we've been talking about, and just the extreme lengths that people have gone to of like not eating the entire day before or making sure that you sweat for like 5 hours. Somebody in the study said that they sweat for 7 hours the night before a weigh-in and like then just go to the weigh-in. And I'm like, can you imagine how gross you'd feel But if the number was where it needed to be, then that would be a win, right? So that's something else too.
And I'm just going to say this quickly, but it requires a bigger conversation. Obviously, there are sports where there's a weight class.
Yeah.
And like that's different. It's like you can strategically get your body to a weight that barely makes it. And then in the next couple of days before your actual competition, you're actually playing or competing at a stronger weight. Like there's strategy behind that. That's different than I think what Lens is alluding to.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Okay. The results of the study were super interesting too. We won't go too in depth with them, but this study was just looking at 11 rowers. But again, I think that I'd be surprised if it wasn't pretty consistent across sports. Another interesting thing that came up that's been normalized a lot was comparing, so younger athletes comparing themselves to more veteran athletes, whether that be training style, how they portray their emotions, whatever it is. And those rookies or younger players being like, oh, so-and-so trains like this, so I have to train like that. That's like saying they eat like that and look like that, so I'm going to eat like that to look like that, right? It's not kind of a one size fits all.
Yeah.
The training part I find really tricky. And we talked about this a bit. One of the results saying of nobody forces you into training. You do it and then you become accustomed to it. So then you get to this point of, okay, I'm injured and I'm sick, but I still need to train if I still want to be number one. So that was one of the interesting results that most of the athletes talked about of whether or not I was hurting or in pain, I've still got to train like a normal day to day.
Totally. My career ended because of that, of pushing through an injury that people told me that I was fine enough to play, but I knew I wasn't. But if I want the playing time, got to do what coach says, got to do what the trainer says. So that's a huge, huge ingrained part of the sport.
And the last one is just emotions and emotions related to health. So again, like we've talked about a lot of these athletes just reporting that something was wrong and I could tell that something was wrong with other players, but I didn't say anything because I didn't want to be seen as the weak one. So then it was never talked about, even though, and they have all these quotes throughout the study, this one athlete saying, even though I knew that things would be better if we just had a conversation. That part makes me sad because like looking back on it, I felt the same too. Like if a conversation was had, things would be better. But there's just that fear because of all those misinterpretations of emotions we talked about. And then with the health, you just sacrifice so much for your body. And that's one of the big normalization things. If you don't train, if you don't eat the certain way, you're not going to be number one, regardless of the harm it does to your body.
Yeah. So again, today we really wanted to kind of like set the stage for the next conversations we're going to be having around just kind of, you know, taking the microscope to some of these normalcies within sport and realizing that they actually don't have the impact that we think that they have and that they are creating harm outside of sport. But, you know, without kind of talking about some of these little isms and these cultural things like beforehand, it sometimes can be difficult to see that what I experienced for 5, 10, 15 years of sport actually has led to some of the things that I'm still currently like struggling with. And again, we're not here to like to whack like coaches on the hand being like, you're a bad person, like you evil person, you. We don't know. Like we're having these conversations because people don't know. These are not supposed to be shame-inducing conversations. They're just, it's education. It's to help you, if you're still a coach, realize that there are more effective strategies to improve the performance of your players. If you're an athlete, it's realizing that you have a voice, that these things that are happening are not okay, and that you shouldn't have to put up with them, and they won't make you a better person. But you know, there's so many more tropes and isms that will just come up in our next conversations. But again, the whole purpose of Lens and I is that we want to improve the relationship between leader and learner, whether that's in sport or as an educator, in a workplace environment, parent, kid. All of this is universally like translatable. We just care a whole lot about sport and is super informative for the rest of so many people's lives outside of sport. So yeah, we're really looking forward to diving into this theory going forward into our next episodes. And just as a little hint, as a little drop into what to expect in the future, we will be having video in our future podcasts come May. So we're really looking forward to having our studio finished and set up, our makeshift studio. It's not going to be all pretty and perfectly designed and everything we want in a studio, but we're going to make it work for a couple of years. And yeah, really looking forward to people being able to digest like smaller bits of these conversations in more like a social media format.
Mm-hmm. Fun.
Fun, fun. Thanks so much for listening today. And again, leave comments, message us if there are certain conversations that you want to learn more about, or if you think that the kinds of conversations that we have would really be helpful or beneficial in your sport or in your workplace. We're there for it. So thanks again.
Thanks. Bye.